Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Victor Picard, professor of media policy at the University of Pennsylvania, who discusses corporate media's surrender to Donald Trump and the urgent reforms needed to support journalism and democracy over profit. Nation magazine columnist Collie Holloway, who examines the white supremacist ideology that's driving the Trump regime's policy agenda and the Obama presidency that set the stage for white backlash. And Jonathan Kutab, a Palestinian-American human rights attorney, who talks about the prospects for peace and coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians in the midst of the current bloody conflict in Gaza. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After President Donald Trump abruptly halted U.S. funding for critical medicines to treat AIDS, clinics in South Africa, the nation hardest hit by AIDS, were forced to lay off staff. The end of U.S. funding has limited pregnant mothers' access to antiretroviral medicines and are now at risk of passing on HIV to their babies. In 2003, Republican President George Bush initiated U.S. funding for PEPFAR, known as the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, to provide treatment, prevention, and care for people living with or affected by HIV/AIDS. The Guardian reports that South Africa had achieved a significant reduction in mother-to-child HIV transmission, with the rate dropping from almost 15% in 2008 to 2.6% in 2024. But without U.S. funds for antiretroviral treatment and other interventions, South Africans will see rates of mother-to-child transmission dramatically increase. UNAIDS, the global agency tackling the AIDS virus, estimates Trump's elimination of U.S. funding for PEPFAR could lead to 6 million more HIV infections and 4 million new AIDS-related deaths by 2029. Winnie Byanyima, the executive director of UNAIDS, asserts, "The message for us is all too clear. This aid model cannot stand anymore. It's too unpredictable. The future has to be less about charity and more about international solidarity." The Trump administration has launched a major reorganization of how the U.S. investigates and prosecutes drug traffickers and other transnational criminal groups, setting out a strategy that would give new authority to the Department of Homeland Security and would expand President Trump's influence on these cases. A ProPublica investigation finds that the plan to bring law enforcement agencies together in the new Homeland Security task forces has been driven primarily by Trump's Homeland Security advisor, Stephen Miller, who's the architect of the administration's militarized mass deportation campaign. Current and former officials said the proposed reorganization would make it easier for senior officials, like Miller, to disregard norms that have long walled off the White House from politicizing active criminal investigations. Adam Cohen, a career Justice Department attorney who was fired in March as head of the office that coordinates organized crime investigations, warned, "You won't have neutral prosecutors weighing the facts and making decisions about who to investigate. Instead, the White House can decide." Longtime farm worker organizer Alfredo Juarez Zeferino was violently arrested by ICE agents in March while driving his girlfriend to work at a tulip farm in Washington State. According to The Guardian, ICE smashed his car window when he asked the agents to present a warrant for his arrest. Zeferino, a leading figure in the independent farm workers union, Familias Unidos por la Justicia, has played a key role in protecting the rights of farm workers in Washington. Zaffarino, now being held in an ICE detention center in Tacoma, Washington, was arrested for an old deportation order dating back to 2018 after he was arrested during a traffic stop in Bellingham, Washington, and local police turned him over to ICE. The activist later sued the Bellingham Police Department for racial profiling and won a settlement of $100,000. The Guardian reports that Zaffarino's detention comes as the Trump administration has launched an aggressive crackdown against its perceived political enemies, including labor union organizers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Over the past 6 months of Donald Trump's second presidential term, we've seen major media corporations bow down to the twice-impeached president in many ways. They've settled frivolous lawsuits for millions of dollars, filed by Trump to harass his perceived political enemies. Major newspapers and TV networks have compromised newsroom editorial independence to placate the president. And media CEOs have contributed millions of dollars to Mr. Trump's inaugural committee and his presidential library fund. Media companies that have surrendered to Trump include Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon and the Washington Post, Patrick Soon-Shiong, owner of the LA Times, ABC TV, and Paramount, owner of CBS News. Consciously or not, Trump and his administration have closely followed the authoritarian playbook practiced by Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban in an attempt to dictate the terms of press coverage of his presidency. Your reporter spoke with Victor Picard, professor of media policy and political economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. Here, Professor Picard discusses how the politically driven bad decisions of giant media conglomerates betray journalistic integrity, and the urgent need to envision a community-based media system that prioritizes journalism, democracy, and equality over profit.
In so many cases, we're seeing not only what President Trump will do, what sort of mafia boss-style tactics he'll resort to try to beat media into submission. He'll basically deploy any tool at his disposal to try to bully media, make sure all media sound and look like Fox News and Newsmax. That's one level of concern, but we also should be deeply concerned about how quickly our media are surrendering to this kind of bullying. And I think it really brings into focus just how ill-equipped our entire corporate news media system in trying to confront this authoritarian threat. And it really brings it to light how ill-equipped they are to serve democracy. And I think in some ways they're doing us a favor by bringing these structural problems into full view so that we know that it's not just a question of trying to shame these media companies into better behavior, but we really need to start thinking in structural terms and thinking about how we can completely transform our media system in the future. Won't happen tomorrow, of course, but it's something that needs to be on our political horizon.
Professor Picard, we've seen court settlements that many really view as out-and-out bribes. Senator Elizabeth Warren was talking about introducing legislation to investigate corporate donations to Trump that many view clearly as a payoff for Trump's shakedown of these media companies. You acknowledge that that might be useful, but it really doesn't get at the bigger problem.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I'm all for it. I think that we should certainly do as much as we can, especially in the moment, to draw attention to these corrupt practices, especially also what's happening at the Federal Communications Commission, which I think is fair to say is the most corrupt FCC in the agency's history. And so anything we can do to draw attention to this and to if we are able to create new laws and policies and regulations that's great, but I liken it to applying a Band-Aid to a festering wound. We really have to get to the structural roots of these problems, and public interest protections, as important as they can be a step in the right direction. We can think about earlier public interest protections, like, for example, the Fairness Doctrine, which I'm sure many of your listeners have at least heard of before. But still, these kinds of regulatory interventions don't get to the structural root of the problem, which is what I would describe as hyper-capitalism. We have a hyper-capitalistic media system that has been so thoroughly commercialized, it overwhelms any other concern. And you still find like individual journalists and news media producers who are trying to do a good job within the current system. And it is possible to really produce really good journalism, but by and large, we're just going to see this continual failure. It's not, our media system for decades now has not lived up to our democratic requirements, and it's only getting worse. And I think we need to move our analysis away from indicting the bad CEOs, the bad corporations, the bad journalists, this kind of bad apples argument, and again, really look at these systemic logics that's making it rational. Indeed, in some cases, it's making it legal for them to do the right thing in some cases. And at the very least, we know that good journalism is bad for business. It's expensive. It might anger powerful people, as we're seeing in this case, it's the president. So we need to design a new media system from the ground up that's driven by democratic values, not commercial values. What I would start out with is looking at public media systems around the world. The U.S. is literally off the chart for how little we allocate to our public media system. But, per capita per year, it comes out to about $1.58 at the federal level. In most democratic countries, and for example, the Brits spend almost $100 per person per year for the BBC. A lot of Northern European countries spend far more than that. Now, I wouldn't just say that we just, we've created the BBC, that would be a perfect system, but certainly a well-resourced public media system that is then radically democratized, also decentralized. But there are different ways that a lot of democratic countries are able to buffer their media systems from these direct commercial pressures, whether they're subsidizing smaller newspapers, for example, to create media diversity. There are many creative means of doing this, but I'd say the overarching goal is to remove news media from the capitalist market as much as possible.
That was Victor Picard, professor of media policy and political economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. Find a link to his recent Nation magazine article titled "The Media's Profits Trump Democracy Once Again" and related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the first 6 months of Donald Trump's second term as president, the nation witnessed a long list of policy decisions that reveal an explicitly white supremacist agenda. On Trump's first day back in the White House, he revoked President Lyndon Johnson's 1965 executive order that prohibited federal contractors from discriminating in employment on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, that also banned segregated work sites. Much of Trump's first 100 days in office have been focused on aggressively targeting undocumented immigrants of color for mass deportation without due process, while welcoming white South Africans as refugees. The administration fired large numbers of federal government workers assigned to DEI programs, as it summarily terminated without cause many of the highest-ranking Black, Latino women and LGBTQ staff at the Pentagon and across the federal government. Trump has also methodically censored Americans of color and LGBTQ history and achievements documented in books, in government libraries, websites, award displays, museums, and federally funded cultural institutions. More recently, the Trump regime has removed the names of Navy ships named after prominent civil rights activists and a gay rights leader, and renamed Army bases honoring Southern insurrectionists who sought to preserve slavery. Your reporter spoke with Callie Holloway, a columnist at The Nation magazine, who's written about how Trump has provided a permission structure for Americans to publicly express their racism. Here she describes the white backlash against the Obama presidency that set the stage for Trump's first and second election victories.
You know, I think that there was a portion of this country that 2008 really was astonished by Obama's election, the election of the first black president, and who never really recovered. I think that Trump's first election was very much a reaction to that. And I think that we are, you know, we've been living in the shadow of that kind of racial grievance and resentment for almost a decade now. Concurrently, what's happening is you see this sort of MAGA rear guard that's doing things alongside the Trump administration. So while he's issuing these executive orders and firing folks who happen to be people of color, but pretending that how that makes them unqualified for their job, and essentially saying that blackness is in and of itself synonymous with ineptitude. There are the book bans that we've seen over the last few years. PEN America, I think their estimation is that roughly 16,000 titles have been banned since 2021. During his first term, Trump was so affronted by the 1619 Project, which was this real accounting of the impact of slavery on America and its lasting kind of legacy, that he put together and paneled a committee to do the 1776 report, which by, you know, any historian who's a serious historian basically said was full of falsehoods and inaccuracies. There were two House bills to ban, quote, CRT, critical race theory, which became kind of a catch-all for anything that the right didn't like. I think that this is an authoritarian regime, but in particular, this regime is very focused on, I think, white supremacy. That is the centerpiece of the Trump agenda. Trump has essentially done everything in very overt ways, I think, to signal what is important to him and the idea that they are going to recenter whiteness in this country. And I do want to emphasize that, you know, this kind of a backlash, obviously we've seen backlashes in the past, but the fact living in the years ahead of 2044, when America is people, I think too often people say, oh, white people are going to become a minority. What's really going to happen is that white people will cease to be a majority, but no group will be a majority, right? There won't be any numerically dominant group. And I think that that is, for a number of white people, the idea of demographic erasure and status loss has inspired a kind of paranoia and hysteria. And I think Trump is a manifestation of that.
Well said, Colleen. Thank you so much. What is your assessment of how the Democratic Party has responded and reacted to this overt racism and white supremacy-driven agenda that we've seen unfold, particularly in this second Trump administration?
We certainly understand that this is an autocratic regime. And I think the Democratic Party has not done enough to push back. I'm not even certain that I know exactly what that would look like, but I think strongly worded letters, for example, are not enough. I think that when you look at what's happening, for example, with Zohran Mamdani in New York City, I think the reason why he succeeded so much in terms of his mayoral bid is that people are really excited to see someone who is saying very openly, look, we're going to push back on Trump's agenda. We're going to focus on what's important to us. We're going to ensure that immigrants and migrants are protected. We're going to make sure that trans people aren't targeted. We're going to make sure that women and people of color feel safe. And we are going to make sure that we don't let ICE run rampant. I think that is something that people want to feel. They want to have candidates to speak openly to that, who acknowledge that the threat is there and who openly state full-throatedly that they are willing to push back. And I think that generally Democrats who are in the national spotlight have not been willing to do that. And I think it's something people are really begging for.
That was Callie Holloway, a columnist with The Nation magazine. Find links to her articles examining Trump's embrace of white supremacy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. 21 months after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages, Israel's brutal war on the 2.3 million Palestinians living in Gaza has killed more than 58,000, mostly civilians, women, and children. Israel's blockade of humanitarian aid has caused severe shortages of food and medical supplies, leading to widespread preventable deaths and starvation. Multiple sources report that 92% of Gaza's housing units and about 70% of all structures there have been destroyed or damaged by the war. Amnesty International reports that since the introduction of its militarized aid distribution system under the U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, Israel has continued to use starvation of Palestinian civilians as a weapon of war. Almost daily massacres of civilians at food distribution sites have killed nearly 800 Palestinians seeking food assistance since late May. Beyond the current bloody war and genocide in Gaza, people across the Middle East and the world are asking whether or not the long-standing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians can ever be resolved. Jonathan Kutab is a Palestinian-American human rights attorney who practices in the U.S., Palestine, and Israel. Kutab, a practitioner of nonviolent resistance, is the co-founder of both the Independent Palestinian Human Rights Association, Al-Haq, and Nonviolence International. He recently spoke about the prospects for peace and coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians at the Unitarian Society of New Haven, Connecticut. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and presents this excerpt of his powerful talk.
During this past century, these two movements, the Zionist movement that calls for a Jewish state, as Jewish as France is French, and the Palestinian Arab nationalist movement, which says Palestine Arabiya, Palestine is Arab. Who are these people coming from all over the world to take over our land? It's like unfair. These two movements have been at each other's throats, and they view each other as an existential threat. Let's be frank and honest. These two movements are mutually exclusive. Whatever lies they tell themselves, their own people and the world. You cannot have a Jewish state in Palestine without dealing with all the Arabs. You can't pretend that it's an empty land. It's not empty. And you can't have a Palestine Arabiya when, right or wrong, for whatever reasons, there's 7 million non-Arabs, Jews, who live there, who have come there. Come as conquerors, come as thieves, come as spearheads of a colonial settler movement, whatever. They are there. And these two movements, these two groups, view each other as an existential threat. Every additional Palestinian baby that is born, or Jewish immigrant that comes in, is a threat to the other side. Every additional acre of land that's taken away from the Arabs, put into a public domain, and then therefore serving Jews only, is a loss to the Arabs and again to the Zionist movement. Can these two movements live together? Can they coexist? Or are they destined to fight each other into, I don't know, extinction, mutual destruction? Can these two groups live together? I believe they can. But in order for them to do so, there have to be some changes in their very basic ideology. Palestinian Arab nationalism needs to change, and I believe it is changing very rapidly, towards an acceptance of the fact that these 7 million Jews living here are here to stay. And Zionism needs to change also to accept that the Palestinians are a people. They're not Jewish, but they belong to the land. It's their land as well, and they can live there as well. You only have to give up one thing: exclusivity. It can be a Jewish state, but at the same time an Arab state. And for my Palestinian friends, my state can be an Arab state, but not exclusively so. It can be also a Jewish state. Is that possible? Yes, it is. Can we create structures that allow Jewish Israelis as well as Palestinian Arabs to have everything they want or need except for exclusivity? Can we create structures for a society that is genuinely democratic and pluralistic, but which respects the individual and the ethnic minorities within its borders, where democracy doesn't mean tyranny of 51%, which allows you to trample over the rights of the minorities and everybody else? There needs to be a constitution that safeguards the rights of the individual as well as the substantial minorities within that state, regardless of who has 51 or 55 or 60% and who has the 40%. Can we create structures that do away with the demon called demography, so that regardless of how many Palestinians, how many Jews come in under the right of return, you can also have a Palestinian right of return, where you don't have to worry about who has the majority, because the Constitution and the institutions protect the rights of everybody?
That was Palestinian-American human rights lawyer Jonathan Kutab, author of the book Beyond the Two-State Solution. Learn more about Kutab's vision for peace and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KODX in Seattle, Washington, Global Community Radio nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.